For over 10 years, VOC Nation has taken listeners behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Our hosts are not only experts on the business, but have lived in the business. Subscribe and hear weekly podcasts from hosts like legendary pro wrestling journalist Bill Apter, former Impact Wrestling star Wes Briscoe, former WWE and AWA broadcaster Ken Resnick, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, former WCW star The Maestro, NWA legend The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, and much more. VOC Nation programming is free on most major podcasting apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Radio.com. And video podcast and bonus content is available on Patreon for as low as $3 a month. What are you waiting for? Head to VOCNation.com and dig into the most comprehensive podcast network built for pro wrestling fans. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at VOC Nation Wrestling Network and follow us on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Thank you for joining another edition of Bumps and Thumps, the talk of wrestling. I'm Brian Ferguson. Today, my guest was in pro wrestling for over 30 years. He's won numerous tag team titles with legends like Roger Kirby and Nelson Royal. He was also an announcer for a number of promotions for over 20 years. In 1995, he opened a wrestling school and trained well-known wrestlers such as Matt Stryker, Sharkboy, Charlie Haas, Nigel McGuinness, J.B. Noble, and Umaga, to name just a few. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Mr. Les Thatcher. Les, thank you for coming on Bumps and Thumps today. I appreciate it.
No problem, Brian. Always a pleasure to talk wrestling. Can I just encapsulate all those 30s and 20s? And actually, I'm in my 61st year in this goofy business now.
Oh, wow.
So I'm actually starting in my 62nd. My first pro match was July the 4th, 1960. I was 19 years old.
Wow.
Excuse me. Yeah.
July 4th, it's America's birthday. How was that for you? How was your first match? What was that like for you?
It was exciting. It was a whole different time, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd moved to Boston in February of 1960. I'd started training with Tony Santos there and had my first match July the 4th, 1960. And most young guys today look at me like they think I'm nuts when I say, and they smartened me up to the business on July the 4th, 1960. In other words, nobody smartened me up the first 6 months. And, you know, well, it was a closed shop.
Yeah.
And thank God. And they weren't going to smarten you up until they were sure you're going to stick. I had been a competitive athlete since I was 7 years old, baseball, mm-hmm. football, basketball, yeah. Et cetera, et cetera. And, but when I got to Boston in February to start training to be a professional wrestler, they tested me. And they basically handed me my ass for the first couple of weeks just to see if I was going to stick around. And I did, of course. And so here we are, 61 years and a little change later.
Yeah. That's great. I didn't realize you were still active in it. Well, that's good to hear. You know, we today, you know, in the wrestling world, it's a whole different, like you said, business than it was when you started. And I'm glad to hear that wrestlers like yourself are still active in it and can teach or mentor these younger wrestlers on the ways of how to be a wrestler, which is probably tough to do because I know I've heard, I don't know if this is true or not, that they basically train them for a few months, or not even that, maybe, and throw them in there. And it's kind of a revolving door. I don't know if that's true or not, but
well, there, you know, to start with, where I trained with Tony Santos in 1960, that was the first ever professional wrestling school,
mm-hmm.
or or camp, period, okay, that was ever advertised, because it was a closed shop.
Yeah.
And I actually found him. He advertised in Wrestling Review magazine. They'd done a story that this guy in Boston was, helping young athletes who aspired to be professional wrestlers, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I had been beating myself, beat my head against the wall trying to find a way in to the business. And I saw that, article in the magazine. So I wrote them a letter and, made the trip. Moved to Boston and to get my start. Now, today, there are places they will call wrestling schools on virtually every street corner.
Yeah.
Most of them are bogus.
Yeah.
Truthfully, there's a handful of guys that I would trust with a good athlete. And, of course, having some natural talent and being able to adjust to what professional wrestling is part of the deal, too.
Right.
But I think the hardest thing for trainers today is kids coming in think, what's all show? It's acting.
Yeah.
It's this, it's that. They think everything but what it actually is.
Yeah.
And the foundation, the fundamentals haven't changed at all in 61
right.
years, and they shouldn't change in the next 61.
Right.
Basics are the basics,
Yeah.
So, it's tougher. And a lot of the things with the young kids that come in today, now you mentioned 95, I actually started... Well, I trained guys when I was wrestling in the business. People like Bill White, J.J. Dillon, Scott Casey, say that I had something to do with their growth within the industry. But I actually started training guys in 91. And, it was different then as it is now. I mean, I was more strict then. When I say strict, if you were training with us, then you didn't bring your kids, your family, your neighbors to watch. It was still, in terms of learning the business, it was still a closed shop. Today, that's not the case. And so today you get a lot of traffic, in terms of warm bodies, but, and there's not that many that actually end up with a good grip on the business and able to achieve their dream, basically.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that. It's a crazy world out there, and you say these wrestling schools around the on every corner, and you're right, there's only a few that are actually legit, and they're hard to find because there's a lot of advertisements for them, and you want to get the best training. If you're paying that, some schools charge $3,000-$4,000 to go to their training camp, and you want to get the most out of your money. And sometimes they don't get what they should. So.
Well, the thing of it is, I think that any aspiring young athlete that's interested needs to realize one thing: there isn't a time frame. I know. Our trainings last 12 weeks. Our training lasts 8 weeks. Our training lasts however. But that's maybe how long you will have a person in your particular school. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean when you turn them loose at 12 weeks that they're ready to be out there. Because everyone learns. Well, Brian, you have a driver's license. I have a driver's license. Did we both learn to drive in the same amount of time? My guess would be no.
Yeah.
And so you can't look at a guy and say, okay, in 12 weeks you'll be a wrestler. You can look at him and say, you look like a good athlete, you look like this, because you realize professional wrestling is unique unto itself. I mean, I have worked with athletes that have won, scholarships and letters at SEC schools and Big Ten schools and, professional bodybuilders, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean you can still be a wrestler, because that's some of the best performers. Well, you mentioned Nigel McGuinness. Nigel had no other athletic experience when he came to me out of college, yet he did turn into one hell of a worker.
He did.
I use that word sparingly in the year 2021 as well, because there aren't a lot of workers. There's a lot of acrobats, a lot of a lot of gimmicks, but worker is special,
yeah,
and which it always has been. But then there were a lot more of those 40, 50 years ago than there are now.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. You know, today, you know, I watch it not as much as I used to, but there's a few out there that still you can see the workers, but you're right. And that's just because of the business. That's what the business has driven them into, doing the gimmick, a whatever.
Yeah, it's the thought now is it may not be broke, but let's fix it anyway.
Right.
And it never has been broke, to be quite frank with you. If you know how to draw a crowd, let's use movies as an example.
Okay.
A movie that won Best Dramatic Film, excuse me, my sinus has been drained, won Best Dramatic Film Academy Award in 1950. Mm-hmm. And a film that won Best Dramatic Award, Academy Award in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
The basics, the foundation of those two dramatic movies will be virtually the same. Now, mm-hmm. over that year period of time, technology's changed, verbiage changes, costuming changes, et cetera, et cetera. But the foundation for building that movie in 50 is the same as building that movie in this year.
Yeah,
and wrestling should be, if you're training people properly, exactly the same as I just described those movies.
Yeah, no, that's a good analogy of that. You got some good analogy. I will say that that's very interesting. Let's talk about you. You grew up in Ohio, from what I've read. What was your childhood like for you?
Oh, I had a great childhood. My mother and father, I think I won the lottery, Brian, on mothers and fathers. Yeah, they were supportive. Excuse me again. They were children of the Great Depression. My dad had to quit school in the ninth grade to help support his family and was managing a automotive repair shop by the time he was 16. My mother finished school. She was basically the athlete if there was of the couple. She played basketball in high school. But I had a wonderful childhood. In my teen years, if you've seen the movies American Graffiti, and if you watched Happy Days, that was my hot rods and driving restaurants, and I had a great childhood, and in the Midwest and in a middle class family, athlete. You know, I played all the ball sports. I was driving race cars. By the time I was 15 years old, my dad I was actually driving on a racetrack before I had a driver's license to drive on the street. But so, yeah, it was sort of an adrenaline junkie. I never thought of it in those terms, you know, back then. But, yeah, I guess that was it to a degree. And I actually loved drag racing virtually as much as I did wrestling, and continued to follow racing once I'd started my wrestling career. But then at some point there had to be a make up your mind thing, you know, it's either one or the other. So it became wrestling, but, great childhood. Actually got hooked on wrestling. I'm 9 or 10 years old. Actually was with the neighbors, on their 10-inch black and white screen. It was the first time I saw a professional wrestling match, and I was just really intrigued and became a fan. Mom and Dad, well, back then, you know, wrestling was big on television.
Yeah.
You're seeing a similar boom currently, but probably like back then, all these companies won't be around in 5 years,
right,
or at least they won't be as prominent.
Yeah.
But what little amateur wrestling I could get had to be in the YMCAs because the public school systems, the high schools in Cincinnati at that point had no wrestling programs.
Okay.
So I had some amateur experience, but it was, like I say, at the YMCAs.
Yeah.
And, but then going to Boston was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was exciting time for a 19-year-old kid.
Yeah. Who trained you in Boston?
Tony Santos was a promoter.
Okay.
But actually, he had his son, who the crazy thing is, Gene Gene Santos, mm-hmm. who wrestled as Gene Dundee. Flash Monroe was another name that he used. Gene was one of the trainers, mm-hmm. although he had never had a pro match at the time, but he grew up around the business,
right.
and he basically oversaw the school. Mm-hmm. But a lot of, Ronnie Hill, Kurt Douglas, these were pros, old pro, Bull Montana, these guys would come in. And so we had several guys that would come in and take part.
Yeah.
But Gene was there all the time. And actually, a crazy thing is, his first match in front of a live crowd, I had with him a year after I started in the business.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But and they didn't, when I said they didn't smarten us up, they
yeah.
did not.
Yeah.
They never told us it was a work until the morning of July the 4th of that year of okay. 60. But how they tried to teach us to work without telling us it was a work was mm-hmm. They'd say, well, you and Charlie go through the holes, switches, but now look, you're not getting paid. Nobody's going to be a winner or loser. We're just going through the motions. So put a top wrist lock on, put a hammerlock on, put a headlock, but don't apply pressure.
Right.
So basically they were teaching us how to work. I wish we could teach some of these kids how to work today because mm-hmm. they're stiffer than boards. But well, as you know, Jim
yeah.
Cornette said, there were a lot of tough guys years ago, mm-hmm. but they never hurt each other because they knew how to work. It was
yeah.
an art.
Yeah.
Today, there's a lot of skinny kids who beat the hell out of one another.
Yeah.
But they're not tough, and think it's cool.
Yeah.
The great, when I say I've wrestled Harley Race, Danny Hodge, Pat O'Connor,
mm-hmm. yeah.
People like that, these guys were tremendously tough.
Yeah.
Great wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
Never felt them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
deal with us, it was like convince the people that bought the tickets. They can't feel a thing.
Right. Yeah.
And, Bret Hart says that no matter how many stars the fans may give to a match, 4 stars, 5 stars, whatever,
mm-hmm.
if somebody got hurt, then it wasn't a good match,
Yeah.
And that was the stance in.
Yeah.
And it was the art, as I learned it and as it should be practiced, isn't much anymore, sadly enough.
Yeah, well, you're not the first person that I've had say that. You're growing, and I hope they change that because, some of these guys, I've seen some articles and things where people get hurt, and it's generally by the same person over and over again, and I would think it'd be difficult to work with the person, but if they're drawing money, I guess it's kind of brushed off to the side.
If you're talking about the same person, I probably think you, which has been in high profile in
yep.
the news because of that lately.
Yep.
I don't know that she's ever drawn a dime.
Okay.
She's obviously dangerous, and something should be done about it.
Yeah.
Which doesn't mean that somebody needs to hurt her.
Right.
But she needs to be back in that performance center learning how not to hurt
people,
her opponents.
Yeah.
That's for damn sure.
Yeah, you're thinking the same person I am, so yeah. So after you got started in the business, I'm sure you developed some relationships when you were driving or flying or... What was that like, your travel experiences from one place to another? I've heard where people talk about their matches, or you get that knowledge from those experienced guys. Is that what you
absolutely.
Had?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of times the ride in the car to a show or from a show
mm-hmm.
was part of the education because you we had veterans
mm-hmm.
To work with. That's the other thing. A lot of these kids today, it's the blind leading the blind. In other words, you turn a guy, this kid's just fresh from wrestling school, and the guy he's wrestling maybe as well,
yeah.
which, well, they're out of wrestling school, but it doesn't mean they know everything or that they know a lot.
Yeah.
This is a learning experience. Realize when I started in the business 61 years ago,
mm-hmm.
we were wrestling 5-6 nights a week.
Right.
And the old timers told you then, hey, it's going to take you 5 years to figure this out and to really get it and understand what it is we're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now these kids today on the independents maybe wrestle once a month, twice a month,
yeah,
three times. That's not every week, that's a month.
Yeah.
So how long is it going to take? And yet the young generation is cocky enough to think they know. They don't.
Yeah.
Everybody learns at a different pace, but
right.
To really understand this business, it takes more. And again, I don't know, you know, my school, when I had my place in Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
your fee was good for 6 months, and we trained those people four times a week.
Yeah.
And you need to be in the ring. And I tell young independents that too.
Mm-hmm.
You need to find a ring and be in it at least three or four times a week, if you can, even if it's not to work in front of a crowd, but just to run through matches.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
With your friends or somebody else in the business, because you can't learn timing, you can't get ring wind any place but in a ring, and you can't learn your timing and execution of things without doing it. It's a business of repetition. It's learning to react. Not to stop, and if you have to stop and think about it, which I see a lot of these kids do now, because they try to plan everything in the back,
mm-hmm.
which is quite utterly ridiculous, but they do it anyway.
Yeah,
you know, well, part of that is because I know WWE, because they have 12,000 cameras, they want to know where everybody's going to be at every second,
mm-hmm.
but that's not the art of working.
Yeah.
You know, if you and I are having a three-fall match and we're going to go 50 minutes,
mm-hmm.
then we need to know the finish of each fall,
which
may take a total of 6 minutes, and the other 44 we better be able to create on the fly.
Yeah. Again, you're not the first person I've had on this podcast to say that. I believe that's a lost art. I believe not just in wrestling, but a lot of other sports like baseball. I mean, I worked in baseball for a few years after I retired from the military, and I was just a security manager. But I would hear that these guys are basically spoon-fed everything, and they don't have to really think about nothing or create anything because it's all there for them. So they can't get creative. Like when you come up in wrestling, and even into the 80s, even into the early 90s, it was all basically you come up with the finish, and everything else was you called it during the match.
On the fly, right?
On the fly,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
And that creative aspect, I believe, is what's really missing from?
And well, now, you know, from there are good coaches that make their trainees learn to call. When I had my school, mm-hmm. everyone that came out of there knew how to call a match on the fly. Now, mm-hmm. if they change that, you know, here's the other thing too, Brian. This is a business, and I tell kids, look, I'm gonna teach you the proper foundation, the proper basics to become mm-hmm. a professional wrestler, and right. and help you grow as long as you know we have some sort of connection.
Right.
But if somebody offers you a seven-figure guarantee a year to act a fool, forget everything I taught you and act a fool.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, it's a business.
Yeah.
When I tell you I don't like a particular character, there's a chance I don't know that person,
right.
but I know the character and I don't like it. That's
yeah.
all. It's not personal, right?
Right.
It's, you know, if Brian is pretending to be, I don't know, a gas station attendant. I thought, damn, that's a stupid gimmick. Well, you don't like Brian? I don't know Brian, but I hate the, you know, it's the character
right.
he's trying to play is
yeah.
nonsense, and I don't like it. So,
yeah.
you know, but that's the other thing, too. You mentioned gimmicks.
Mm-hmm.
Gimmicks got over better in our day.
Yeah.
And for the simple reason is everybody didn't have one. When
right.
when Dusty passed away, you know, some of the young guys that I knew would say, well, you were there when he was at the top of his game. And I said, yeah, yeah, and we'd talk about it. And I said, but, you know, the one thing, they'll talk about his charisma and his promos. And
mm-hmm.
I said, you know, the one thing that helped Dusty immensely to get over that you don't even think about, you guys, what's that? He was the only Dusty Rhodes in the business. There
yeah.
weren't 10,000 of them. And
right.
everybody around him wasn't a gimmick.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The expression over and over and over and over that I've heard for 61 years is less is more. And that's less with two S's, not one,
yeah.
not my name, but with two. And it's true.
Yeah.
Example, are you married, Brian?
I am. Very
All
happily.
Right. Remember the first time you saw your wife naked? Of course you do.
Yeah.
Do you remember the 300th time? Don't bother to answer me, Brian, because your answer is the same as my answer. The answer is no.
Yeah.
Because you became complacent with that.
Yeah.
I give you 10,000 dives every show, 10,000 false finishes. I yeah. kick out of your finish. You kick out of my finish. Then how the hell is it a finish, and what's the value of it?
Yeah.
So much that I see in the ring now and is public masturbation. It's guys entertaining themselves.
That's a good analogy. I like it.
It is. I mean,
yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
This spot is so cool. I want to do it three times. Well, you
yeah.
friggin' idiot. If you know how to do it and the proper time to do it, you will elicit a great response.
Yeah.
But just doing it to be doing it, does it fit in context? Look. A good wrestling match is like good sex. Begins with foreplay and builds to a climax.
Yeah.
And I watch a lot of these young guys and think they've never had good sex either. They obviously don't know what. Maybe you should be teaching that instead of wrestling. I don't know. But you get my point, right?
Oh, yeah. You got some good analogies. I will say that definitely. Let's talk about your, you know, you teamed with some well-known legends, Roger Kirby, Nelson Royal, just name a few. What chemistry with wrestlers? I mean, who do you think, in your opinion, was your best opponent that you just had that click, that it factor with? That
oh,
you just,
wow. You know what? I don't know. I've worked with so many talented wrestlers.
Yeah.
And learn from, I mean, my God, I can go back early in my career because Ripper Roy Collins,
mm-hmm.
who probably most modern day fans wouldn't even know who the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But what a great leader and a great 1963. We were in a show in Iowa somewhere. And Roy and I had a three fall match and he called the whole thing because I was still in the learning process. But
right.
we were tearing the house down. It was just great. So we're going back to the dressing room. And Pat O'Connor, who was one of the owners of the territory, along with Bob Geigel,
mm-hmm.
And was on the card as well. Pat was the main event. And so as we get to the back is where Roy and I are both, it's a long hallway. Normally the wrestlers aren't together back in 1963, but in this particular instance we were. So as we walk into the main dressing room, Pat's there, you know, waiting for the intermission to be over. And he says to Roy, how the hell do you expect anybody to follow that? And Roy said, if you can't follow it, maybe you should go on before it. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, he just said that to one of the owners and a former world champion, right?
Yeah.
I'll be fired tomorrow. But it was there, you know.
That
you have those nights. I've worked with some Ken Lucas, who's another name you probably have never heard. One of the best workers I've ever locked up with. I've had him as tag team partner. Flair, in his book, mentions that Kenny was one of the best men he ever worked with, and yet Kenny is not a... There were a lot of great workers in the 60s and 70s because you had to know how to work. Yeah. Today, you know how to be a bad comedian or be an acrobat, which has nothing to do with working in terms of professional wrestling, right? Yeah. And so there were so many great guys back there. Talk about chemistry with partners.
Yeah.
I have a sarcastic sense of humor. You mentioned Kirby and Nelly. Yeah. I tell people I train the future junior heavyweight champions of the world because they both were after we were partners, right? Of course, I had nothing to do with them becoming champions, but I've always been a contender as a junior heavyweight during my in-ring career, I wasn't tall enough, or I just didn't have that it factor. But of the junior heavyweight, I've wrestled Matsuda, Hodge, Mantell, Kirby, Royal. Am I missing anybody? I don't think so. Five of the world champions over my 20-year in-ring career. So, I have had an amazing life in the wrestling business. It's had its ups and downs. It's not so good now for whatever reason. But, yeah, I look back and, I think I gave a lot. I think I did a lot to positive things in the business. Mm-hmm. But I also feel that it's not a job if you enjoy doing it all the time.
Right.
And truthfully, at this point in my life, I still want to be involved. I'm not going to wrestle, but I can still teach.
Yeah.
I can still, broadcasting, whatever.
Yeah.
I've made a joke out of it for a number of years. I keep saying, I'll probably be doing something wrestling related when I die. And the closer I get to that, I'm thinking, I'm hoping I'll be doing something wrestling related because it's been my life,
Yeah. I want to tell you, you don't. I don't think you give yourself enough credit, and I don't think people that watch wrestling in the 70s and 80s, they know who you are. And I found you because I knew who you were. And once I actually read some of your bio and found some information on you, you are very, to me, underrated as a pro wrestler, all-time great. And I want to tell you that. And I appreciate you for what you've done for this business because your credentials are just amazing. And I think it's underappreciated. And I want to tell you that I want to thank you for what you've done for this business.
Well, I appreciate
that. And I'm not saying that just because you're on my podcast. But I really mean that.
I'll be candid with you. I have never been a great self-promoter.
Yeah.
This is true. I'll be the first to admit that.
Mm-hmm.
But in recent years, as you get older and start thinking, I don't give a damn what anybody thinks, right?
Yeah.
I'll say what's on my mind.
Right.
Yes, I feel I have contributed, and I feel that the one thing I haven't accomplished is to get a Hall of Fame ring. And I do believe that's overdue, and I believe that I've earned it.
Oh, yeah.
So,
definitely. The Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, they should be calling you right now, telling you to get down there and get that.
Well, while we're talking about that, just briefly, start at as a trainer, you mentioned a handful of the guys, and I've my fingerprints on a lot of the guys. And currently, Drew Gulak, Adam Cole, besides the guys you named, and and some of my drills that I've concocted for wrestling are used in the Performance Center, OVW, Rudy Gonzalez, Tom Pritchard. Top trainers in the world use my stuff. Yep. Okay. The first wrestling t-shirt ever on the market was put out in 1972 by three guys named Jack and Jerry Briscoe and Les Thatcher. Artwork by Jerry the King Larm. Whose idea? Mine.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's interesting, see?
Yeah, we put out... Well, the idea at that time, realized in the 60s when t-shirts started being any other color but white, and most of them have concerts or writing and everything. Mm-hmm. So in the early 70s, it just crossed my mind, and I mentioned it to several promoters, and they weren't interested. And Jack and Jerry and I were sitting around Jerry's apartment in Charlotte and just having a couple of beers and just talking in general. And I brought up my frustration that I thought t-shirts would sell. And Jack said, well, why don't we do it? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, why don't three of us, we'll all kick in and we'll do t-shirts. And we did.
Yeah.
So that's how the industry got started. I changed the look of wrestling magazines with the Crockett's. Mm-hmm. We put out the only NWA full-color magazine in 1975 or 76, whichever, with Terry Funk, who's a world champion at the time, on the cover. That was done out of the Crockett office. I did five issues of a similar magazine for WWWF. Vince Jr., that was at the same time, and then I did Crockett's Mid-Atlantic. No one was doing artist-rendered theme covers. We did. Mm-hmm. No one is doing centerfolds. We did. Yeah. Full color. We did.
Wow.
And so forth and so on. And, and then television, we're right here where I'm living currently in Knoxville, when Ron Fuller bought this territory in 1974.
Okay.
He called me and he said, I just bought the Knoxville territory, where I had been one of the top baby faces here in the, in the late 60s and early 70s anyway. So anyway, he said, I know nothing about television. I want you to come in and develop me a TV show. You have carte blanche to, you know, just make sure it makes sense.
Yeah.
So instant replay, split screen, a sit down, low key pre-taped interview in the middle of your show. I had people tell me it won't work. Everybody does it now.
Yeah.
We did it first in 1975 right here. So, then we can talk about the four Brian Pillman Memorial shows.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
98, 99, 2000,
let's talk about that.
Did you?
No, let's go ahead and talk about it. I mean, I've heard of it.
You bought that because that 20th anniversary anthology is out with all four of those shows.
Oh, well, I haven't bought it yet, but let's talk about it. I mean, obviously that was your idea.
It was, yeah. I mean, I had a lot of help. Those shows, in 98, we figured I was going to do one show.
Mm-hmm.
And it just started growing from that point. I had Benoit and Jericho were going to be my main event.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Steve Austin had been Brian's tag team partner and dear friend. He was going to show up. Tammy, Sonny, was coming. And so, talking to Dave Meltzer, he said, you know, all you need is an ECW match, and you got the three big. And I thought, gosh, I hadn't thought about that. I had never met Paul Heyman at the time.
Yeah.
But Candido and I were buddies from him working Smoky Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So I called Chris, and so I ended up with stars from all three companies under the same roof at the same time.
Yeah.
No one, and you couldn't get that anywhere else in the world, Brian. And we did that in 98, 90, and it grew in 99, it grew again in 2000. That was if you haven't seen it yet, it's out there on Benoit Riggle classic match from 2000 Pillman show.
Okay.
We raised $120,000 for the Pillman family over the four shows.
Oh, wow.
And was the only place in the world you could see ECW, WCW, and WWF/WWE yeah. all under the same roof on the same night.
Yeah, I'm really surprised that they allowed their guys to do that. I know they're the two bigger ones at the time, WCW and WWE. I know they have a lot of constraints on those.
Well,
guys.
You know what? I want to think, and I can't reach and pat myself on the back. I'll leave that up somewhere. that part of it was because they trusted me with their talent.
Yeah.
That I wouldn't screw things up.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And those shows were blow. I mean, the guys worked for nothing, right? They came. I mean, the three big companies paid the airfare. We put them up in the hotel, fed them, et cetera, et cetera. And those shows, there were pictures with the photos with the stars. Mm-hmm. We had auctions, J.R. Stetson, D'Lo's chest protector, Flair's robe, woman's gown, et cetera, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
there was so much going on at these things. And you can, if you go to PillmanShow.com, that four-disc set is over 15 hours of content,
okay.
a lot of extras, but it covers all four of the shows and how they grew. When we did the first one, it was in Norwood's Junior High School gym, which is where Brian went to school.
Okay.
And we moved from there to Cincinnati Gardens and then to the St. Xavier Fieldhouse and on, you know, so the shows just took on a life of their own. And wow. So all these things I'm pretty proud of.
Yeah.
And I want that damn ring. What can I tell you?
I don't blame you. You sound like a very creative person as well, not just in the ring, but, you know, with your creating T-shirts, creating shows, creating
concepts.
Well,
you know what? And some of the stuff that I've done in this business has just almost been by accident.
Yeah.
Now, as a kid, one of my suppressed desires, I guess, was to be a 50s rock and roll DJ, right?
Mm-hmm.
because I just thought that was one of the coolest things in the world. I don't know if you ever watched the old WKRP in Cincinnati.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah, Johnny
Dr.
Fever.
John Fever, yeah.
This is cool, yeah. And I'd done a little broadcast. When we built the drag strip in Cincinnati, there was a club called Southern Ohio Time Associate. It was a group of hot rod clubs, of which mm-hmm. our club was a member. We built a drag strip in Cincinnati. And so I did the tower as the tower announcer for a while, you know, calling the races and stuff. So once I met Gordon Solie, I thought, damn, this is the best. Because I realized back in the 50s and the 60s, a lot of your wrestling commentators were just the local kitty show host or news guy they weren't necessarily wrestling fans themselves or necessarily even qualified to call a wrestling match, right?
Yeah.
They were just local celebrities
who
got $50 or whatever it was to do a 1 hour show.
Yeah.
And so when I finally went to Florida in 67, when I was made the NWA Rookie of the Year, I met Gordon. And besides, we had racing in common as well because he was part owner of the Golden Gate Speedway in St. Petersburg. But anyway, I thought I'd like to try this sometime.
Yeah.
So I was wrestling for a former tag team partner and neighbor in Charlotte, Rudy Kay, who was promoting in the Maritimes up in eastern Canada. And he said, come on up and wrestle for me in the summer, the season for 1970. So I was up there doing that. And his spit it out, Les. His lead, and that was his only announcer, was a guy from Toronto and had a death in the family and had to go back to Toronto. So we're living in Moncton, New Brunswick at the time, and Rudy calls. We're wrestling in Moncton on Monday, Halifax on Tuesday, and Halifax Wednesday mornings where we did TV. Mm-hmm. So he calls me, and he says, we're just talking in generalization. And finally he said, you know, when we were running them down the highways in the Carolinas, you talked about how you might like to do wrestling play-by-play. And I said, yeah, I remember that. And he said, well, now, when you pack for Halifax tomorrow, bring a sport coat and a tie. And I said, why? And he said, because you're going to be my my television commentator. And Rudy and his brothers were known as Rivers, right?
Yeah.
And so the first thing I'm thinking, right, I'm gonna bring dress clothes. I'm going to get all dressed up and show up at the TV station. They're going to say, we fooled you, right? Yeah. But he finally convinced me, no, unless I'm telling you, this is a fact, you know. My guy had to go back to Toronto. He's going to be there for a while.
Yeah.
So I ended up, it was basically by accident.
Yeah.
And so I had been interviewed on television, but I had never seen a format, never cued in or out of a segment in my life. And I started that Wednesday morning in Halifax in 1970.
Wow.
And so I was a natural at it, I guess, or good at it.
Yeah.
And so he finally came to me, and after a couple of weeks, he said, look, I'm going to leave him in Toronto. I want you to finish out the season. I'll pay you extra over and above what we've talked about, your guarantees for wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finished out the season. He wanted me to come back the following year and work in the office and produce the television, help write it, and so forth, so on, and just work in the office. But I only been wrestling 10 years at the time, and I still had a few bumps or a lot of bumps left in me, I guess, and still had things to prove to myself. So
right.
I passed on that. So ended up coming back in the Nashville office, then down into Florida. And from there, Danny Miller and I, Charlotte was looking for a number two babyface team behind mm-hmm. Becker and Weaver, and the bookers in Tampa recommended Danny and I. But we both have worked the territory in the past. So anyway, we go in, and one day I'm in the office talking to Mr. Crockett, this is Jim Sr.,
mm-hmm.
and Lord Littlebrook is there, who had been up in the Maritimes with me in the summer.
Right.
And Brooks says to Mr. Crockett, why aren't you using Les? I can't do the English accent. Why aren't you using Les on your TV, Mr. Crockett? And Mr. Crockett looked at Brooke and he said, well, Brooke, he's on my TV. No, 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 I don't mean as a wrestler. You know, he was Rudy's commentator in the Maritimes last year and just did a great job. And Mr. Crockett looks at me, he said, I didn't know that. I didn't think you cared, right? So that's how I worked into doing something with him, right?
Yeah.
And so that grew, and so, you know, I ended up being a lead broadcaster on the B show there.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started handling, coordinating all the interviews, and then in the war in Atlanta, I moved to Atlanta for a while. Gordon and I were the broadcast team for Georgia Championship Wrestling, and then back to Charlotte, and then in here. I went from 74, November 74 to November 77, I was jumping back and forth between Knoxville and Charlotte. I had an apartment in Charlotte. My week would start there. I'd wrestle three nights a week there, but like I had my own cubicle at the office. And Gwen and George Scott and I and Gene Anderson would sit down and go over all the interviews that we were doing in Raleigh on Wednesday and to coordinate those, and I'd make up my cheat sheets and this and that and the other thing and wrestle a couple nights, do our TV on Wednesday, come back into Charlotte on Thursday, Friday morning, get on a plane to Knoxville, Ron picked me up at the airport, have lunch, go to his house, lay out the TV, wrestle in Knoxville Friday night, Knoxville TV on Saturday morning, spot show wherever on Saturday night, back on the plane to Charlotte on Sunday. And this mm-hmm. went on from November 74 to November 77. I was past myself in the air, Brian. There I go. Here I come. Right? But I loved every minute of it. And the Crocketts gave me creative freedom with the promos, what George Scott did, and I had creative freedom in the magazines there. I had creative freedom with the television here, and I was tickled to death. I mean, I was. It was great. So, but
that
well, the television thing, Ron needed something done, and I filled the bill with the T-shirts. We filled the bill with being a broadcaster. You know, it's just kind of being in the right place. Well, as a trainer, I was doing competitive bodybuilding till I was from age 46 to age 54, and training bodybuilders, working with Pearl of Performance in Cincinnati. We worked with pro bodybuilders and pro athletes. Anyway, Bob Harmon, who was the original Beautiful Bobby, a Cincinnati boy, mm-hmm. called me and excuse me, mm-hmm. and said, I have this guy's got a wrestling school here in town. I didn't even know this. And he's got some idiot as a trainer, and he's got to get somebody that knows what they're doing so, you know, he can keep his doors open, because these guys may start leaving because this guy just is a complete fool. And I'm listening, wow. and so I said, okay, question. Why are you telling me this?
Yeah.
You're that guy. I said, you're out of your mind. So he talked me into going to one of their shows, and it was the first independent show I'd ever seen, and I was horrified. My business has come to this, excuse me. Saw this guy go out and get a chair, and I could tell by the way he was holding the chair, he didn't know what he was doing with it, and he cold-cocked his opponent and left him, basically, he was out on his feet. So I lean over to Bob, who's sitting between myself and the guy that owns this school and this promotion, and I said, that kid doesn't have a clue what he's doing with that chair. He could have, you know, I'm sure he cold-cocked him. I said, how long has that kid been wrestling? So Bob leans over to the guy that has a school and comes back and said he's been to, like, 6 practices. I said, my God, he's got no business being in a match. Never mind using a chair on somebody.
Yeah.
So I made up my mind, okay, I'm going to try this. So, and thank God, I fell in love with training and ended up opening my own place, and the rest is history, I guess. So, but all these things basically have just fallen in my lap, or come around by accident, you know?
Opportunities, you know. That's that's great. I want to talk to you. You know, you've been honored a few times. I've read that you at Cauliflower Alley Club awarded you their Art Abrams Lifetime Achievement Award in 2005.
Yes.
Now, you also, if I read correctly, you were on the board of directors for there for a while. Was that correct?
Yes, I was for a couple of years.
Did you enjoy that?
I would have enjoyed it more if it hadn't been so political, to be quite honest with you. Harley and I ran training camps out there for 4 years as well.
Okay.
And they kept getting larger every year, and then they shut us down. It was a whole political thing as well. I won't get into that whole thing. But what? You know, we started the first year we did that, I think we had around 20, maybe 25 kids.
Okay.
And the last year we did it, we had 70.
Wow.
And the other good thing about doing it at Cauliflower Alley back then is, hey, here's Harley Race and Les Thatcher running this school, and Scott Casey, because he and Nick Bockwinkel had a school in Vegas, Scott was helping out, but then Nick Bockwinkel comes by and throws in his 2 cents. Here comes Jack Briscoe. He throws in his 2 cents.
Yeah.
Here comes Danny Hodge. So realize all the people that are in that, you know, at that hotel during those 4 days. And so to get a shot at listening to, you know, sitting in front of all those learning trees at the same time was great. It politically, it ended up cutting our legs out from under us. So, you know, it was. And it's the horrible thing is the wrestling business is there's always that's the thing that I hate. If you want to use the word hate or disgusted with or don't want to be a part of is the friggin' politics.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
If I do something right, pay me a good fee and let me do it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't want to kiss your butt and I don't want you to kiss mine.
Yeah.
The magazine things that I did with the Crockett's was basically because they gave me my head. I mean, and don't get me wrong, Brian, I make a mistake at least once a day. I'm a human being.
Right.
You know? So I don't do everything right.
Right.
But I know my guidelines. And I look at it from working the territory days, whether I was doing magazines and TV and wrestling for Crockett's or whether I was doing the same thing in Georgia for them or here for Ron, I'm a hired gun.
Yeah.
You pay me right. And I'm a loyal employee, right?
Yeah, right.
And I'm going to do the best I can, not necessarily for you, but for me, right?
Right.
I've got a reputation I plan on protecting as best I can. So, You know, and the corporate politics are even worse to me, you know. Well, the boss's wife has dyed her hair red. This everybody's wife better get red hair. Right? Come on. Stop it.
Yeah.
You know, it's that stuff just doesn't interest me in the least, you know.
Yeah.
It's hire me to do my job, right. And a funny conversation in 85 when Vince was just starting to build his thing into a global power. George Scott was booking for him, you know, and George and I had a great relationship in the Carolinas. So they called me and flew me up, and I went to Stanford to sit down with Vince and George, and they offered me to come in and oversee all the promos and all the interviews and coordinate them. And of course, at that time, those were done every night in soundproof tents in the back of all the Coliseums, you know, and you might be out on the road, hell, 8, 9, 10 days at a stretch.
Right.
And the offer was great. You know, the money was good. It was, there was, you know, hospitalization and et cetera, et cetera. But my dad had just passed away a couple years before.
Yeah.
I was living in Knoxville. My mom was just 4 hours away up I-75 in Cincinnati. And they wanted me to live in Stanford.
Yeah.
So that kind of, you know, shut the deal down. I was involved in a couple of other things, projects.
Yeah.
So I turned them down because, well, they said, well, you move your mom to Stanford. No, I can't because she doesn't know anybody in Stanford to start with. Had they allowed me to continue living where I was at, and I probably would have taken the job, you know. But I passed on it, and... you know, it is what it is.
Did you ever work for the AWA, American Wrestling Association?
I wrestled for them a few times when when Kirby and I were in Kansas City in 63. We went up there and worked a few TVs for them. When Okerlund left AWA to go with Vince, they called me. Jack Lanza. Called me. He was booking for Vern at the time. I was living here in Knoxville, and offered me. He said, "You know, Gene has jumped to Vince," and I said, "Yeah, I'd heard that. We're looking for a lead announcer to play by play, and we thought, you know, your name came up. We want to make you the offer." And I said, "You guys are taping every week, right?" And he said, "Right." And I said, "Well, that'd get off crazy flying me in every week. Oh no, we want you to move here." I said, "Well, then that's." That's the end of that deal.
Yeah.
I have no desire to winter in Minneapolis.
I've
been there
you.
In the winter.
Yeah.
Have no, you know, I just, you know.
I understand. The winters there are rough. I'm from Wisconsin, right next door.
Oh,
so
okay.
I understand it perfectly. I live in Missouri now, but when I was a kid.
Well, you know, I'm an Ohio boy, so I'm not, you know.
Yeah.
Unfamiliar with snow.
Right, right, right.
But the difference between Cincinnati and Minneapolis is about a foot and a half, I think, deep. So,
yeah.
It just, and parking my car at the Minneapolis airport, and I find out, okay, you got to plug your engine block into a heater. Okay, I'm good in Cincinnati or Knoxville, whatever. But that was, so, you know, I've had good, I've enjoyed my run. I truly have, Brian.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I've left a good legacy. I'm proud of my body of work.
Yeah.
I don't think any one individual thing that I've done would make me a Hall of Fame candidate, but I think collectively, yes, and I'm not afraid to say so.
Well, I'm 100% in agree with you, and I'm sure people that are going to be listening to this on the podcast would agree, too. Especially when they go and look up who you are and what you've done, you should have been in the Hall of Fame years ago, in my opinion, and probably in opinion of a lot of people. So, if I had a vote, I'd say you're in. But
well, thank you.
Unfortunately, I do not. But
if I ever hit the lottery and I can afford all you guys that are willing to vote for me.
You'll do it.
I'll buy you membership into the Hall's voting staff.
Okay. Oh, all right. So One last question, then we'll let you go, sir, is what are you doing now? What kind of projects are you working on?
Well, I'm getting more. Well, I've been doing training camps, right? Of course, okay. With the pandemic. Tom Pritchard and I did a weekend here in Knoxville. It's been like, 2 years ago this past August. But okay. I'm available. If someone would, I mean, I still can run weekend training camps.
Okay.
They can reach me, lesthatcher28@gmail.com, if they're interested. You okay. know, and I'll send them out all the information and everything. Okay. But right now I'm getting involved with, Ron Fuller, who we worked so well together
yes.
here, you know, during the 70s or Southeastern Championship Wrestling. Mm-hmm. And Ron's moved back to the area, and he has a YouTube channel now called Southeastern Rewind.
Okay.
And one of the things that you can catch he and I on there most Fridays, or it's posted Friday or Saturday, I think, mm-hmm. We do a rewind review, which is he's putting up a lot. He's put up some of the Southeastern shows from here. He didn't save a bunch, sorry to say. But yeah. He came back here in 98, mm-hmm. or in 88, excuse me, and started USA Championship Wrestling here in Knoxville. So mm-hmm. He's running that show earlier in the week, and then he and I are sitting down and just kind of picking it apart, you know, and talking yeah. about it, why the angle, why that storyline.
Yeah.
How this is working, you know, break down the booking for, you know, whatever reason,
okay. and
analyze it a little bit and pick it apart some, you know?
Yeah.
So, and so he does a weekly stud cast, right? Talking about, yeah. you know, he was a Tennessee stud, but anyway, yes. So starting October the 13th here in Knoxville,
okay.
we're going to be doing a evening, live stud cast at Calhoun's on the River, which is a really nice, barbecue, they're noted for their barbecue, a nice restaurant mm-hmm. right down by Neyland Stadium here at the University of Tennessee. And okay. the restaurant's very famous in this area. Anyway, we're doing a Wednesday night. We're going to start doing the second Wednesday night of every month.
Oh, okay.
2 hour awesome. Live stud cast, dinner with the stud.
Yeah.
The first hour will be his normal stud cast. The second hour will, you know, Q&A with the fans who are in attendance.
Okay.
They get their meal. Autographed picture of Ron and I. We're going to give away door prizes, which some of the door prizes will be wrestling collectibles and Q&A session. Dinner is the Calhoun's barbecue buffet with coleslaw, beans, barbecue with all the different flavor, you know, quality mm-hmm. of sauces, iced tea, lemonade, also a cash bar. And
okay.
it'll be for 2 hours from 7 to 9 at Calhoun's here on the river starting October the 13th. And if you're interested, you can go to tnstud.com. That's Ron's website.
Okay.
And click on Stud Store
okay.
and make your reservation there. It's $30,
okay.
which covers your meal and everything, right?
Wow.
So
that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I think so. Well, the meal is their food is exceptional. And plus, you get the autograph pictures and the chance to win some of the door prizes and stuff. So we're going to do that October and November, this, and skip a December simply because of the holidays
right.
and start back in January of next year. But then next June, Brian,
yeah,
June 3rd, 4th, and 5th, the first weekend, we yeah. are doing Southeastern Memories, celebrating the history of Knoxville's pro wrestling, which goes back to John Kazana's promotion, who Ron bought out, and the first man that I wrestled for here in 1968 was John Kazana. This is going to be at the historic Jacobs Building in Chilhowee Park. Jacobs Building is where we started wrestling back then. And it's going to be, you know, a fan fest. There'll be matches on Sunday afternoon, but there'll be, you know, memorabilia, you know, tables selling merchandise. There'll be Q&A sessions. There will be photos with the stars and so forth and so on. Yeah. And that's going to be June 3, 4, and 5 of next year. And, of course, we'll put more ads out about that.
Yeah.
But so I'm kind of involved with all these. It's fun to be back. Ron and I always, we're more than just working relationship. You know, we're buddies, and we've been friends for 50 years. So it's fun working with him. He gives me my head, and I pick at him, and he picks at me. So those are the things. And like I say, I'm still available to do seminars and weekend training camps. In fact, I want to do them. I truly do. So,
well, folks, you heard that, and I'll put that, Les, I'll put that on the description at the bottom when this gets posted here soon. And I want to thank you again for coming on, taking your time today, and I really appreciate it. I've learned a lot. I'm sure the fans that are listening to this have learned a lot, so we really appreciate it. Thank you very
much.
Well,
I thank you for having me, Brian, and I hope I didn't bore everybody to death.
No.
But we're talking about my favorite subject in the world, and that's wrestling, not me. But wrestling is, you know, it's been my life, and I enjoy it. So, yeah, we can do it again sometime.
Oh, you
and
bet.
And if you're going to be in the you get down out of that wintry cold, survive it, and come on down and join us next June for the Southeastern Memories.
I may take you up on that. I'll have to talk to the wife, and I'm sure by then we're looking to go somewhere. So, yeah, definitely. So I appreciate it. Again, everyone, Mr. Les Thatcher, thank you, sir, for coming on. Appreciate it. And go ahead, sir.
My pleasure, Brian. It's been fun, and thank you for having me.
Oh, you bet. And please, folks, if this is your first time listening, subscribe. We've got more stuff. And thank you again, everyone. And Les, we will talk to you soon, sir.
Take care.
All right.
Phil Apter has been in the pro wrestling business for over 50 years.
Okay, talking here with Arn Anderson. Arn, first of all, your height and weight.
6'1", 255.
And now subscribers to VOC Nation Premium get exclusive access to Bill Apter's archived audio footage.
And where's your hometown?
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay, and give us something about your back. First of all, your relationship to Ole Anderson.
Ole is my...
Subscription to VOC Nation Premium starts at just $3 a month and includes commercial-free audio and video versions of our top podcasts.
Okay, we're speaking here with the manager of the World Heavyweight Tag Team Champions, Tarzan Tyler and Luke Graham, and he's sort of glowing tonight about a new prospect we haven't heard of yet.
And for just $9 a month, Apter's archives are all yours.
Would you tell us who this new prospect
is? Well, I'll tell you, Bill, I've searched the world, and I finally found a true world champion. I finally found...
What's your opinion of Ivan Koloff winning the title from Bruno Sammartino?
Well, I think... I don't know what to say, but I want to say one thing. Bruno was a hell of a champion. You know?
Hear exclusive interviews with the greatest performers of all time.
This is Bill Apter, and once again, we're speaking here with Bruno Sammartino. Bruno, first of all, how did you and Bruiser lose that title to the Valiants?
Well, actually, it was a very unusual loss, if you want to call it a
did
loss.
Did Heenan have anything to do with this?
Well, yes, but the whole thing is this, that the rules, as I always understood them, was that the title could only be lost by pin or submission, which is the same rules as my title, the World Wrestling Federation. That night, it was...
To sign up, it's very simple. Head to premium.vocnation.com or go to patreon.com/vocnation. VOC Nation takes you behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history.